Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another episode. Today, after numerous requests, an uncountably large number on the internet and on the Twitters, I have a guest back. Seth Partnow from The Athletic, the one and only. Seth, people were tired of me talking to myself. I was tired of me talking to myself, so thanks for coming on.
Sure. So uncounted requests means like two or three?
It was more than that, but...
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone.
It was slightly more than that, yeah.
Okay.
So, but I think I'm trying to figure this out. Is this technically the first time you've been on this show? I can't even, I have no ability to remember back into the past anymore.
I don't know, because I feel like we've been on so many
different podcasts.
Cast together,
right,
in various, including the one and only episode of quote my podcast back in the days of yore.
Is that in the Smithsonian, that one episode?
I don't know. That was a good episode.
Yeah,
we had an interesting conversation.
We did have a very interesting conversation, and what people don't know about that is the technical difficulties we fought through. I think it really brought us closer together.
I think so.
So you made a big announcement this week about a book that you're working on that's coming out, that I think a lot of people who are into, you know, basketball analysis, thinking of the game more deeply, they're very excited about. Can you talk just at a high level what we can look forward to with this new Seth Partnow tome?
Well, people looking forward to it coming out. I have to write it first.
So minor detail.
Yeah. Minor detail. I can't name it Thinking Basketball because that's already taken. But I mean, it's certainly, if one wants to talk about the kinds of things that it's going to be about, I think that's thinking about basketball deeply. It's going to be something of an anthology. There's been dozens of books written this way about baseball in the sabermetric era. A little bit of kind of a statistical primer. I don't think there's actually anything out there that's like, hey, what does all this stuff mean? And hopefully I can do that interesting and readable way, but also, you know, just topics around things we've learned about basketball, where it's been, where it's going. And I'm most interested in doing the research for the things I think might be coming in the future. Because that gives me complete license to be hilariously wrong. And in thinking about this book, I actually owe a fair amount to you. When I was approached by the publisher, Triumph Books, much earlier this year, I was like, oh, a book sounds nice. What the heck should I write about? You gave me some advice that I think was very helpful, which is not to be afraid of, I think you called it my back catalog, in terms of both of us have done a whole lot of research and writing on a lot of topics. And so there are things that we kind of have known intimately and covered in some detail, but the broader range of our audience is probably not minutely familiar with everything we've done. So I don't want to say collating that, but bringing a lot of that kind of research and thinking together into a coherent whole that kind of describes a vision of NBA basketball, I guess.
Putting it in one place is tremendously helpful.
And tying one thing to the next, because if there's one thing that I think we both agree on to a great deal, it's how kind of one thing leads to the next. And a lot of the mistakes that are kind of made in piecemeal analysis is kind of forgetting that, you know, the end of an instance of whatever is not the end. It's also the start of the next thing. And that kind of transition between the two matters. And so fitting pieces into the whole is as important as the pieces themselves.
So the thing you wrote about, I guess it came out today, I think,
On The Athletic.
It's very confusing for me, because when I was growing up, something was in a newspaper, and then I feel like at a certain point it was at a website, but But now when I open the app in the morning, it's in the app, right?
It's on the app.
On the app. Okay.
On the app. Yeah.
I got to keep up with the times. You'd think, having designed apps before, I would know this. But anyway, you were writing about sort of the role players in the series and for the Lakers and evaluating their contributions in a small sample. It actually reminded me a little bit of a topic that I hit on in Thinking Basketball, where there are instances, the 2003 Spurs are the team that I used, where you have guys who from one night to the next contribute, but the overall averages look underwhelming. And so when someone goes back and looks at the team from a longer lens in the past, they say, oh, this team had like one or two players and then a bunch of guys doing nothing. But it was the ability to get certain contributions, whether it's on defense, shooting, playmaking, whatever, from night to night, that kind of helps prop up that supporting cast.
And I'm going to try out a thought for you that just occurred to me for the first time.
Perfect. That's what you're here for. Now,
yeah.
Now we're getting
there. So this is sort of teasing something that we've had planned for after the season at the Athletic, which is I'm going to be doing tiering basically the top 125 players or so in the NBA, and part of that is based on some research that was first done by Kevin Pelton, and I've kind of recreated and duplicated and confirmed. There is not a replicability crisis in this area, but that player production, however you want to say it, is nonlinear in so far as a player who's worth one win. Okay, that's worth a win. A player who's worth two wins, okay, is worth twice as much. Once you get up around the four-win area in terms of winning a championship, each additional win is worth more. So player who is responsible for six wins, however you figure it, is more valuable than a player who does four than the guy who does four than two, and even more so as we kind of move up the ladder.
Yes, this was in Thinking Basketball as well, this idea of the portability curve.
Yes.
Right. So keep going. This is definitely up my alley.
So I'm thinking that even though, like you're talking about, the average across these games of these players is minimal, the fact that in any individual game, one guy is going to have a large contribution in that game might operate on a similar principle in that, if you have five guys all being pretty good, that gets you one place, but you're probably better if four guys are a little bit lower and the fifth guy is much higher. If you're whatever production metric you're using, that might sum to the same thing, but the overall effect is probably better when you have the one guy and everyone else. And so having that in the Lakers standpoint, obviously you have two guys who are going to be very productive almost night to night. But having that third guy who can be a different guy every night also being very productive is maybe better off for them than having, four guys who are kind of at a decent but not super contributory baseline.
I've always been fascinated with this kind of the difference between the average of something in basketball and the actual distribution, like the range of it. Is it really high variance? Is it consistent? And for me, this goes back, I think it was about 10 years ago, Neil Payne, when he used to have the Basketball Reference blog, you remember that?
Yeah.
He tried to look at the differences in high-end players. We're talking about role players, but he looked at high-end players and he said, well, a guy like LeBron's really consistent and that may help a certain type of, quality team. I think he compared him to Kobe, who had sort of a higher variance in whatever metric he was looking at. And he's saying, like, if your team is a little weaker in general, you want these higher variance guys who can hit these home runs, basically. Because if your team is weaker and you're trying to upset someone, you're more, this was what he laid out, you're more likely to have success in that upset with a star that can get you to huge heights. It kind of plugs back into something you said at the end of your article about finals MVP, where if you look at the performances in wins, you only need four wins in a seven-game series. You can have three duds, right? So it's that kind of thing, but you're applying it here to role players and it might have a different application.
Because across a season, you're kind of dealing with aggregates and like, okay, you know, 30, 35 marginal points is worth a win across, it, you know, an 82 game schedule, but especially in the playoffs, there's some, you know, some pretty strong inflection points. You're not there. There's less time to get them tomorrow. If you, you know, if one of these performances swings a game in a series. So I do think there's something to that, especially with respect to the role players in a situation where teams are reasonably even. And this has been not unlike the Western Conference Finals. I think this has been a reasonably closely contested series where I think the difference can almost be that like the Lakers, other dudes are shooting the ball much better than the Heat's guys. Now, some of that is the quality of looks, but like the, you know, shot quality, it tells more over longer term than the shorter term. So, so I think that's a way of saying that because they're getting these night to night performances from Alex Caruso, from Rajon Rondo, from KCP in the three wins, and Markieff Morris was a reason why the game three was close. I think that's a big part of why they're winning the series.
Yeah, I mean, for me, intuitively, it's an interesting thing because on one hand, you would think if you've got stars, you want consistency from the players around you. We can maybe get into home court versus playing on the road research. I've done some of this in the past. I don't know if you've looked into this with like role players versus stars. But that aside, the idea that if you're a good team, you can get sort of for you know, lack of a better way to think about it in basketball, a third star on any given night or a fourth star on any given night from whoever it may be, KCP, Rondo, Dwight Howard. I don't think he's had a game like this, but Kuzma maybe, you know, come in, hit a bunch of shots, add 20 or 25 points. This seems to me that especially the way the playoffs are laid out, you're going to get slightly more value from those kinds of role players, especially if you have an army of them to choose from. And you allude to this in your piece about Frank Vogel trying to press the right buttons here and throughout the playoffs. But it seems to me that, at least in theory, that's going to give you more value than whatever averaging metrics, as good as they might be, will spit out, because they can't account for that kind of variance in the distribution.
Yeah, I think that's what that we may be, it's possible we're overthinking this. Put the two of us together, and that's always that's always in play. But yeah, I think there's something to that. And then I'm wondering, like, it used to be like you needed a quote a big three, and wondering how possible, as kind of the general ability of front offices has risen, which I think is broadly accurate over the last 20 years. It's probably a little harder to put together a big three, just in terms of you need some kind of you know, freakishness, like, you know, Steph Curry signing a very below market contract right before a massive cap spike and a second round pick become an all-star at the same time to be able to put that kind of talent together under the league rules. So I do think that it might be more okay, you've got your one or two main guys who you can reasonably count on every night, but then having those other guys, like we've been talking about, who can be that you know, third leg on any given night. It's an interesting question, actually, whether or not there is anything to needing three. If there's any sort of point of inflection in terms of game to game performance, where, okay, if you have one guy who plays great, that probably gets you somewhere. If you have zero guys who play really well, you probably lose. If you have one that does something for you, if you have two that does more, if you have three, is that like, where is the line of demarcation for when it becomes like you probably win if you get this?
Yeah, I actually, just using a basic box metric years ago, looked at the correlation between better and better individual games and winning. And there's a pretty healthy correlation there. Like, it makes sense, right? In the NBA, right. If you have some huge game like Jimmy Butler had the other night, there are enough parts in play where it certainly could be a loss, but almost it's like almost becomes independent of team quality. If you have a phenomenal individual game, you're more likely to win than not.
I want to just pause there for a second. I think if this we're recording on Friday before game five, if the series ends tonight, as I think we both suspect it will, I'm a little worried that Jimmy Butler performance will kind of get lost. That's one of the great individual finals performances of the last however many years.
It was phenomenal.
And stepping back from it for a moment, just like, you know, I wrote about it the other day, just in terms of the stratosphere of the control he had over that game is in a range that has been reached by LeBron, and that's it, in the last 8 years. Mm. So, you know, and I just wanted to put a pin in that and drop a marker there, I guess. Put a pin is the other thing. before we move on, but just it's sometimes sad that these like great performances and teams just kind of like vanish. Like, when was the last time you thought about the 13-14 Pacers?
Well, every time I have to think about what happened to Roy Hibbert, that's pretty much it. Even more so than my Paul George adoration over the years.
Yeah.
I should say we've alluded to the article that came out today that you wrote. We've alluded to your Jimmy Butler piece. The Athletic is the sponsor of this podcast. And right now, there's a limited time, incredible offer I have for you. It's $1 a month for the first 6 months. Head over to theathletic.com/thinkingbasketballpod. That's how you can support the show. theathletic.com/thinkingbasketballpod. Sign up there. You get the first, let's do some math. The first 6 months for $6. And you can read, you get everything Seth wrote, right?
Everything from me, everything from John Hollinger, everything from our wonderful group of beat writers.
Jared Weiss, all those guys are fantastic.
All those folks. Across sports, I think we have about the best soccer and hockey coverage out there. If you're a big football guy, really doing a nice job there. This is covering what is kind of one of the weirdest seasons that anyone has seen. And it's, that football is experiencing that kind of in real time, even as basketball and hockey and baseball have somewhat navigated playing in this weird environment. Football is now anyway.
So theathletic.com/thinkingbasketballpod. Thanks for the assist on that. I always forget to do that during the show. Let's come back to what we were just saying, though, because I think if I can take a step back, I think what we're really getting at here is sort of small sample evaluations. Like, we have tried to prop up in the best way we can over the years, going all the way back to the 90s with pioneers like the aforementioned John Hollinger and Dean Oliver, people like this. We've tried to say, okay, how can we evaluate basketball players? Here's a season of data. Here's a playoffs worth of data. Can we reduce these things to single numbers or kind of put people on a level playing field and wrap our head around this? And I think what we're really getting at here is, how do you confidently make evaluations in really small samples, whether it's a game or even a series, a 5 or 6 game series? What does it look like? I've always had this question about finals MVP. Like, what does it look like to go into the series and say, yeah, this player was on level, 9, and the next closest player was on level 6?
So the interesting part you said there, the most interesting part of your question was, how confident can you be? And I feel like that's where we fall down more than almost the evaluation itself is we're looking for too high a degree of confidence almost. Like this is, there's a lot of, unless you're going to really like, you know, rewatch all the games four times and take copious notes and, you know, go to the tracking data and everything else.
Don't mock me, you know, Seth.
I wouldn't think of it.
Continue.
No, but how certain can you be? And in a reasonable time frame, what's your best estimation? And I think that's what a lot of the metrics, whether it's a one number metric or kind of a suite of indicators that you like to use. I think a lot of that is really just, you know, helping you reduce the complexity in your mind somewhat. So you have a starting point and then, okay, here's kind of broadly what I think happened. What else happened that might shift my evaluation up or down on each of these individuals? And so, yeah, you can have your, whatever you think of what Anthony Davis did from a statistical standpoint in game four, but then he guarded Jimmy Butler for, you know, 50 some percent of Jimmy Butler's time on the floor. And especially in the second half, once they started going under on screens, like that very much limited Miami's entire offense. And is that, how much of that credit goes to Anthony Davis? Some, a great deal, but the fact that he could stay in front of Butler and not have to switch off was a pretty big key in the game. And that doesn't really show up anywhere in a stat attributed to any one player, but that's something that makes you, at least in my mind, that's the kind of thing that you get watching the game that makes you think, okay, whatever my suite of numbers says this, and then he gets a plus for this other thing that was a pretty big key to the game.
Well, I think there are competing forces here, which is what makes it so fascinating to me. It feels like it's easier to look at a single basketball play and say, oh, he did that really well or he did that really poorly. Like, we can wrap our head around that. We don't need to deal with reducing things to one number or whatever. We can just look at the play. He made a shot. He made a great pass. Or if it's defense, like, what more can you do on this defensive possession than lock up, go through the screen, rotate, lock up the player, contest, turn and rebound? And yet, as we start to add more of those together, at a certain point, we're stuck going like, well, I don't know if we have enough of them to actually say how valuable each of these things are, right? Like, there's certainty in identifying these individual instances, 1, 2, 3, 4 plays, 10 plays or whatever, maybe. But then you get in this middle range where you're not really certain. You know what you just saw, but you're not really certain at how valuable it is. That's sort of the fascinating tension that I see in looking at it.
Yeah, and just you describing this it reminds me a lot of I've been talking with a lot of people about kind of scouting technique, I guess, you know, in anticipation of moving towards, you know, draft coverage because, you know, Russ never sleeps. And one of the things people have been talking about a lot is feel. And it's one of those things that you just watch clips on a player you don't really get because a lot of that is seeing the progression of learning throughout a game. So I almost recoiled when you said you can watch one play and, oh, he did that right. It's like, well, what is he reacting to? You know, okay, if it's the first play of the game, it's whatever, but okay, this is the third time they've run that action. He defended it this way that the first time, and how has he adjusted or has he? That's almost as big a factor as, but now look, just look how much complexity I've just added there. So even your example of like looking at one play, just picking that one play as the start and the end points, like takes you away from what is actually, you know, going on in terms of the decisions the player is actually making.
Right. Yeah.
Does that make any sense at all?
No, that makes total sense. I don't think it competes with what I was saying. I didn't have in my mind that you wouldn't have that information. I was just thinking, like, even if you're in the third quarter and you know you've had these two adjustments and the team is trying to do this and the player then actually executes that like as well as the coach would want, we could play a mind game and say, you know, in some thought experiment, there's no other player in the NBA that we think could execute that as well. It's still very hard for us to say what that is worth in a single play. You referenced in your latest piece, Jacob Goldstein's PIPM at a single game level, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's hard for me to even understand what that means in a sense. I've certainly looked at really small filters with his stuff, and I think he regresses a lot in small filters, meaning he shrinks the numbers closer to zero. But like, we're so used to thinking about and have kind of learned through all this research, all these studies, everything that's gone on in the so-called analytics movement of the last 20, 25 years, we can now kind of intuit, okay, you're not going to put a basketball player on an NBA team and they're going to add 50 wins. We can intuit that. But what does it mean at the play level? And then how does that affect our ability to assess, you know, not just like how well someone actually played in a game from a remotely reasonable qualitative standpoint or quantitative standpoint, but when we get to these, you know, massive arguments about like finals MVPs, what was the actual value of what this guy did in a 4 or 5 game series?
I mean, this turns on as much on the definition of the word value as anything else, doesn't it? Because like what it's a little bit of reasoning from first principles, right? The goal is to win the championship. How do you win the championship? You win 4 games. So then that necessarily, you know, colors the and I don't have a good answer for how, but it you know, doing, you know, having this a ludicrous performance in a blowout, you're probably there's probably some overage there, right? if you score, you know, 50 in a 27 point win, do you really get, like, how many of those 50 should actually count?
Yeah.
When we're talking, like, obviously that's a tremendous, so let's call it 49, because, you know, 50 is a round number and people lose their minds. But say you have 49 and you win a game, you win by 25. How much better was your game than if you'd have scored 41 in terms of driving towards winning a championship? There's probably not any difference there.
Well,
so
keep going.
No. So, and I don't know where that leaves us. Because a lot of when you get down to like this level of granularity, it almost becomes like art criticism rather than statistical analysis. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, we need to kind of recognize that it becomes very subjective very fast.
Well, I don't think it's totally trivial to, maybe that's your point, to clarify at the least what we're talking about. Like, I'm a big proponent, I've said it before, of a playoff MVP versus a finals MVP, but I'm not even sure MVP is really the right term for me. I think I'm more thinking of like a playoff MOP, a most outstanding player, to use the NCAA terminology, sure. Right? I think that's at least how I intuit those kinds of things. And to your point, there's no right or wrong way, but I think we constantly talk past each other, even if we can agree that our analysis is like really spot on, because it does become a different thing the way the rules are laid out to say who's the MVP versus the MOP. As an extreme example, I've advocated for a playoff MVP and said you probably, like hockey, I think, has had this as well. Like, you could probably, certainly in soccer, you could probably find instances of people that don't make the final who, over the course of, like, how many playoff games did Jokic play? He played 19. So you could probably find somebody who played 19 playoff games and you could muster up an argument that they were the best player in the postseason and deserving of being acknowledged as the best player in the postseason if we went in that route. But I think it would be hard to then argue he was the most valuable if you've got some other guy who does the things on a championship team that keeps getting him to the next round if they're reasonably close in performance. So, you know, I do think it is worth pointing out at least what we're trying to talk about, because then it's still a difficult task to parse.
Yeah. It's crazy to me, like, as we think of Denver as having this great playoff run and they lost more games than they won in the playoffs.
And we're outscored, I think, over the
which is, you know, but at the same time, I still think they had a very successful playoffs. So like they finished under 500 in the playoffs, but I think they performed very well. I mean, some of that is the fact that I think that the Western Conference Finals were a subjectively a closer series than 4-1.
Yes.
But again, art criticism.
Well, so let me put you on the spot here.
Yeah.
I have thought over the years, this isn't something I don't think I've talked about much lately, but way back in the day, we have this idea of like a team's net rating, its point differential, its SRS, which it tries to adjust for schedule or whatever. So you have some value at the end of the season. You say this team is neutral, this team's plus five. Great teams like Golden State, the 96 Bulls, maybe they're plus 10, plus 12. I have always thought that those regular season indicators kind of give you a ballpark of a team's overall quality, but based on many of the things we're talking about, role players, distribution of stars, of course, a hot topic lately has been matchups and, you know, your flexibility in the playoffs. I've always thought that that is kind of fungible to a couple points either direction. So the area I'm putting you on the spot here is, do you kind of see it the same way, or do you think there are teams that legitimately could be, I don't know, 500 teams in the regular season and way, way better than that would indicate in the postseason, and vice versa, where you have a team that looks like a world beater in the regular season? I'm not thinking of any team that you used to be affiliated with here at all. And then maybe they just don't have the same level of bite in the playoffs. How do you kind of see that stacking up, I guess, that signal as you think about a team? Denver makes me think about this because they look like a decent but not championship level team in the regular season. And you could make the argument that they're probably better in the postseason, but I don't even know if that's the case. Like, I don't know how to kind of get out of that mold, if you follow.
Sure. So the first thing we have to acknowledge is, like, until proven otherwise, I think we have to treat this year's playoffs as a little bit sui generis. Just in terms of, I mean, you've talked about it, having, you know, it's not, especially for young players, it's not the same season. It's next season already for whether it's, you know, Tyler Hero or Jamal Murray. I mean, adding, you know, he says 14 pounds of muscle between like the shutdown and the playoffs, like
pure muscle.
He was visibly like stronger and more explosive. I think it was like I feel like the extra strength was a big deal for his performance in the bubble and playoffs. So,
Michael Porter Jr. as well, I think.
Yeah. I think that's sort of one thing we just have to leave out there. So like a team that performed kind of much worse in like the campus environment than their regular season numbers would indicate, I don't think that necessarily says anything, makes any big pronouncements about that's almost more like saying, yeah, they were really good last year, but not as good this year. And same players, but we're not really sure why. And that happens all the time. You know, a team, you know, that Hawks team basically ran it back and just wasn't as good. They lost to Mark Carroll but still. That's one thing. I don't think there's ever going to be a situation where a team is like a neutral net rating team in the regular season and then plays at like championship level sustainably in the postseason.
I think the closest, I agree with you. So it sounds like we're on the same page. I think the closest team for me to ever kind of looking like that was probably the 95 Rockets.
Well, but they're an example that's often used for something like this, and they made a massive trade midseason. So in general, like season long performance is a predictor, with the caveat that if you make a big change, it's not. So the two big examples of that are, you know, the 04 Pistons and those Rockets, who, you know, made big trades midseason and that kind of altered what their team was. So kind of a big chunk of their of the sample that generated their their net rating or SRS or whatever is out the window.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't disagree with you that there are teams that are that there's probably some, the spread is not that big, but I do agree that there are definitely teams that based on their construction are going to be different in the playoffs and regular season. I think that this is going to become more of a thing too, because I think playoff basketball, and we talked about this on Nerder last week, I think, is that playoff basketball is diverging more from regular season basketball than probably ever before.
Yeah. No, I buy that. Keep going.
So that's one thing. And you can look at it a little bit. Like the two kind of best teams in the NBA this year in the regular season were the Bucks and Lakers. And a big part of their kind of statistical profile was the degree to which both of them just pounded on the bottom 10 teams in the league. I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say there were 50 something and one versus those teams. And the Lakers had, I believe, one of the best net ratings of all time versus, you know, teams that are, you know, whatever games teams played this year that prorated to 35 win pace or lower. And the Bucks were similar. They had two enormous, like, which probably inflated their season long net rating by a little bit. Now, was that predictive of postseason success? Well, the Lakers turned out fine and the Bucks less so. But I do think that's an indicator that, you know, how you did against Cleveland this year doesn't say much about how you're going to perform in the second round of the playoffs.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring it up from that perspective. I had at some point a Patreon subscription article that looked at the performance of those teams against the top 10 teams. And what jumped out there is that Milwaukee at that point in time had this incredible, like, historic all-time net rating, but their performance against the top teams, I believe the Lakers were first, and there might have been another team in front of the Bucks. And it wasn't that the Bucks looked problematic, but when you stack them up next to these other great all-time teams, they looked more like another one of my teams in this sort of vein that we're talking about. They look more like the 90s Sonics than the 90s Bulls.
Yeah, I mean, the way I've kind of used it, tiered the league into three tiers, which is like 35 and below and 50 and above win teams. And that it seems to, you know, at a rough approximation without getting in and fiddling with, no, this team was a good team this year, this team was a terrible team, and having to fiddle around with that for every season. That gives you a rough approximation. And this year's Bucks, like, turned out to be solidly, like, upper tier, like in and amongst a lot of teams that, like, made finals and won championships in terms of their performance against the other top teams, but they weren't that, you know, historical right. Outlier type of plus 10, plus 12 team. You know, you want to talk about teams that did that and did not win a title. The one that always comes to mind was Oklahoma City. The year Westbrook
13.
Hurt in the first round of play. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that is one of the, I think that's one of the, it's hard with all those Warriors teams, but that's probably one of the 10 best teams in the last decade. And I think they would have won the title that year. Had Westbrook not gotten injured, because they're one of the bet in that subset of sample against the other top 10 teams, they were just crushing that season. And then, you know, first round of the playoffs, and Pat Beverly does Pat Beverly things, and there we go.
So we did allude to it on that podcast last week, the Athletic show Nerder She Wrote, where I was mentioning Anthony Davis, defensive versatility. I, of course, did a video about him this week, and I continue to sort of plugging back into this conversation, I continue to think about these two extremes where, on one hand, if you're going to have more matchups that you have to handle over the course of a four-series playoff run, do those players become more valuable? We can speak to offense, of course, but just even on defense, where if your key performers are guys that have this flexibility to take on different roles, play in different coverages, play in different schemes, how much more valuable is that than, to me, the opposite right now, and the one I was really noodling on in preparing my top 10 video to end the season, which will, this is Friday, it'll come out in a couple days after this is over, but I get into
who's
number 10.
Yeah, that's one of the so the top nine are
pretty
easy.
Yes, this is exactly what I had. I ran into this problem where 10 for me was actually, I looked at, I think 10 through 16 I had arguments, and maybe it was 15, I had arguments for six or seven guys.
Oh, this is going to come. Our lists are going to end up being so familiar, so similar.
We can share notes after the. I don't want to spoil too much, but yes, that one of the challenges is I do this list and I block out the ranges. But in this case, there was an entire group that could be almost interchangeable from like 10 to 15 or 10 to 16 for me. Anyway, one of those players is a defensive drop
coverage. Is Rudy Gobert.
Exactly. And so this is this is what I was kind of working through, where it's like, on one hand, I'm thinking the Anthony Davis, and we could Bam Adebayo, other players can go in this mold, are becoming more valuable in the playoffs.
Are there others that can go that? I mean, Jonathan Isaac, if he has.
Yeah, Jonathan Isaac, Draymond Green, historically. Yeah. I mean, but it's, of course, we're talking about the elite of the elite. But the flip side, and I have a graphic in the top 10 video that alludes to this, is if you are kind of primarily a drop coverage center, we mentioned Roy Hibbert, like it's a similar idea. He might be a more extreme example. If you really excel in one defensive area or skill, and to some degree we've seen this with Dwight Howard and the Lakers, how likely are you to kind of be defanged at a certain point? And then what does that do to your overall kind of championship equity as a key defensive driver if the system is built around you, but it's a rigid system? These are the kinds of things I'm thinking about. What are your thoughts?
This is a tough one for me because, especially around Gobert, the conversation goes in weird places, and he kind of, he tends to get blamed for his team having a dearth of shot creation. And I think that, and that's honestly one area why he is a more kind of playoff durable player than this model of Dwight Howard or Roy Hibbert. Like, people forget. I mean, I don't want to do like the snoring
the problem,
emoji.
The problem.
No, but Roy Hibbert was a legitimately terrible offensive player. Like, he was a bad finisher around the rim, was not effective in pick and roll, and so the problems there became almost as much that he's a liability offensively. Rudy Gobert is not an offensive liability. Like, good hands, can roll, catch, finish, offensive rebound. Like, he's not a shot creator, but he's a guy who requires attention and can't be schemed away from a he's not a guy who you can stick a small forward on and think you're going to get away with that.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I think that Roy Hibbert, like, sure, we'll guard him with Kent Bazemore or something like that, and what are you gonna do, post up Roy Hibbert? I think that's a big difference, and I don't think Dwight is as much of an offensive liability at this point in his career, but he's also no longer the defensive force that, you know, Pete Hibbert or current Gobert is. So he kind of falls in between. But I see your point. I think, does it limit you in certain ways? I don't know. I feel like the drop coverage discussion is a little bit reductive, because where is that getting you beat? And who is that getting you beat by is my question.
I think the obvious answer, and I get your point, there's more nuance, but I think the obvious answer is if you've got a really good spread pick and roll structure with a guy who makes pull up threes, and probably to some degree you want volume shooters around that as well. But that's where I see the primary weakness. If you've got, at some point in the playoffs, it's hard to avoid really good offensive players. Like, you get to the second, the third round, you're going to run into these guys. And therefore, when one of them is, you know, hey, let's set a screen 30 feet from the hoop or 25 feet from the hoop, and I want to spread you out. Gobert's a great example, I think, where, yes, the conversation goes in really weird directions. I've defended the fact that in the past that he doesn't suddenly become some liability who can't stay on the court. That's not the point. The point is that if you look at a guy like Gobert, who's got great mobility for his size historically, there's a huge difference between him coming up to touch a screen and be 20 feet away or 18 feet away and then handle an attacker into that space. And, you know, these situations we've seen in the past with Lillard, with Curry, maybe with Murray when he was really hot, and Mitchell on the other side of the court, more and more. Trae Young is probably coming. Luka likes to use more space like this. Like, when you get out to 25 or 30 feet as a big and you have that extra dribble or two, I think that's the thing that makes a difference. You can even see it with Anthony Davis, who I think is more mobile than all of these guys. Like, that extra step or so to the three-point line is just the thing that a guard can use to actually get by you. And then, of course, the second they're getting by you, you're introducing more help into the scheme and the coverage, and that's what you're trying to avoid in the first place.
Yeah. Are we over-indexing on the Warriors?
Possibly. Keep going.
No, it's just like, yeah, how much of, and this is a Rudy Gobert discussion. This is a James Harden discussion. This is a Daryl Morey's general managership discussion. It's like, we're, oh, they couldn't overcome, you know, one of the four or five dynasties of the last, you know, 25, 30 years. One of the great collections of top end talent we're ever going to see in the NBA. He couldn't match up with that. Therefore, it's just like, okay, sure.
Yeah, I don't think that's the right way to approach it. If that's where you're going.
No, but I do think that like this stark terror of a guard coming off of a mid pick at 30 feet and destroying a team, that is Steph and other good players around him. And that's the Warriors, and that's it. Like, okay, for a couple games, maybe Lillard can do that. And, like, you know, he won game one of the or sealed game one of the first round series against the Lakers. But what, even before he got hurt, what did he do for the rest of that series?
Well, yeah. So I would just flip it and say, like, I'm thinking about the Kemba Walker, Marc Gasols of the world, right? Where it just seems to be something that is more common if you have guys that are really comfortable setting up in that space on the court and they're going to go to a pull-up three or try to get to the rim. They're comfortable with the ball, so they're going to be the primary shot creator for a team out of that kind of action. The Celtics, of course, run a ton of screens and staggered screens for Kemba. And then you get into a series where you start looking at where you can gain advantage points. And there are just stretches where it's like, okay, yeah, he's older now, but he's still an example of a very effective defender in shorter space. But having to ask Marc Gasol to take that extra step or two out on the perimeter, now we've got a defensive problem that we have to contain. I don't know if you completely buy that, but that's more about the framework that I'm thinking of it in.
Yeah, I don't disagree in the part I disagree with is we're so selective about which of these kind of micro situations. Oh, that's that. He's done. He can't do that. He's done. And this is like the discussion of drop coverage in this year's playoffs has been that, I think. It's with the guy hit two pull-up threes this game, just can't win with him.
Well, that may be very fair.
I'm not saying you're doing that, but you are doing that a little. So there's all kinds of, you know, yeah, there's not a player in the league that doesn't have, if you want to find some deficiencies, like, you know, does LeBron have a habit at the end of game, the end of close games,
sure,
to dribble out too much?
Right,
shot
right,
clock?
Right.
And
sure.
Is that, you know, it's like,
but I don't.
And but we've chosen to not decide that's a fatal flaw.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to the point you're making about automatically assuming something is a fatal flaw. I think where I go is what happens, and I'm not saying they're right to do it after two plays, but it seems to me that coaches will do it after 5 minutes or 8 minutes or getting somewhat of a larger, maybe still not sufficient sample. What happens right. when the coach is the one who's like, okay, this just isn't working. It's just, it's giving up too many things that we want to contain. And therefore, I'm going to start sort of structuring or navigating my defense around this because I don't want to give that team those shots. That's the shots that they want to get. Those are the places on the floor they want to get to. And therefore, now you go full circle back in your brain to like, if you've got Bam Adebayo, if you've got Giannis, whatever, you just say, okay, just adjust the coverage slightly. Just come up higher because they're more comfortable and sort of a fleet of foot in those situations.
No, I don't think that there's of course there's value in being versatile in that area. But I think there is a delta in defensive ability between Rudy Gobert and Bam Adebayo. And I don't think Bam's versatility makes up for that completely. And I think there's a danger he can do all these different things. Yeah, but Bam is not yet a top defense in his own. He's not a guy who, he is on your team, you have a top 10 defense. Rudy Gobert is. So in some situations, again, the versatility helps close that gap, but we don't want to just make it all about this one area where, you know, Rudy Gobert, you know, top two or three rim protectors in the league, top two or three rebounders in the league, and a very effective offensive player. So, you know, and I don't want to turn this into like a Rudy versus Bam, you know, discourse, because Bam has a lot of time to get there. But I think those improvements for Bam are going to come more on the offensive end than I think, you know, he's as a rim protector, he's probably, you know, he's because of size, he's unlikely to ever be elite in that area.
I love your Rudy Gobert is a top 10 defense argument. Framing, whatever.
And so I've said this on multiple podcasts, and I'm going to have to say it again because someone's going to go look it up and see that they were 11th in defensive rating this year.
I was going to ask you what you make of
it. But you go to our friend Ben Falk's website and you look in non-garbage time and they were 10th.
Sure. So even at number 10, I was just going to ask you what, because I think that argument, I like that argument for historical purposes because I work so much on, you know, like the inflection points on defense have really big consequences for building teams, winning playoff series, and they're the thing that is the easiest to miss at a high level. We can talk about playmaking, passing, scheme, movement, all these other beautiful things. But just at like a high level, you know, Ben Wallace used to just be demonized as a basketball player, for instance. So I love that. But my question to you, and I have the same question to myself when I looked at it, is like, man, what happens when, you know, we know there are great defensive players who, if things start to really fall apart, you just can't be a top 10 defense by yourself. But what happens when you're like, oh, there's another year at 12, there's another year at 14, there's another year at 16. It's one thing if there's just obviously no defensive coaching effort or talent around you. But, I mean, do you make anything of that they seem to be slipping a little? Whereas a couple years ago, they were just flat out number one, right?
All right, I think that to some extent that is the team around him a little bit is not as good defensively this year. They probably had one of the best backup center situations in the league last year when okay, Derek Favors, you play the five now.
Yeah.
So they you know, and this year it's like Tony Bradley, Ed Davis, Juwan Morgan. So that they're, you know, the time he's off the floor is worse. And then also just kind of switching their team around to bring, you know, having the titular four be Bojan Bogdanović. It's like that's, right. You know, and Mike Conley is probably almost certainly not the defensive player he was earlier in his career. And it's just, you look at their lineup. When they were in their preferred starting lineup before Bogdanović got hurt, is there another player on the floor who's even an average defender?
just throwing Royce O'Neill out of the discussion, you mean?
Oh, no, when you bring Royce O'Neill, you get into that situation where you have a guy who is close to a passenger on offense.
the Oklahoma City special, can we?
Yeah, I mean, I think he might have been the lowest usage player in the league this year. I think that might be wrong, but his offensive role is stand in the corner, stay there, and that's fine. But that is not really a plus factor on an offense. That's a get away with, that's a park a guy who can't field anymore at first base.
Yeah,
kind of situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think examining it in totality and you also have to note that, you know, it was noted during the year that his kind of effort level and overall play wasn't as good as it has been in the past. So maybe that's a sign of slippage. Maybe that's, you know, just one of those things, because there are ebbs and flows. I mean, prior to the shutdown, there was some obvious tension between, you know, Mitchell and Gobert.
I don't remember what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. No, Dave Dufour and I were at the game they played in Boston right before the shutdown, and we were just like throwing our hands in the air at the number of times where Gobert would roll to the rim and be the only person in the paint and not get the ball. And so he expressed some frustration and commit a dumb foul on the other end on defense. It's like, okay, that's not great, but that's also human. So I don't know where this is going, and I don't know why this has turned into it to me. Not for the first time engaging in a full-throated defense of Rudy Gobert, but
with a Rudy Gobert defender, the irony of that.
Yeah. So where are we going with this? So
I have no idea.
If he's at an age now where if he starts to, you know, next year, they're 12th, it's like, okay, he might just, is it the league has moved away from that being a valuable thing, or is it he's hit the crest and is now on the backside of the wave, which, you know, intuitively probably matters more for defensive big guys than a lot of other positions, because a little decline in kind of athleticism probably makes a bigger difference than it might be for a shooter.
Yeah. All right. This is probably a good point to wrap up the podcast.
We're gonna end on Rudy Gobert.
I don't know we're doing anymore.
I mean,
if there's anything else you want to talk about, we could do a post show. The Patreon subscribers like that. We could stick around and hit another topic or continue the Rudy Gobert. I don't know how we got so on Rudy Gobert. It's my fault. The drop coverage.
No, it's weird because it was defensive versatility and top 10 players and whether Rudy belongs there or not, or whether you want to put Jimmy Butler there. That's my guess. am I wrong?
Tune in to
Ben's.
You'll find out in a couple days.
Yeah.
If you have a few minutes, let's do a, because I do have a thought. Let's do a post show on Jonathan Isaac. I want to ask you something about him. Otherwise, you can support this podcast at patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. Sign up over there. I can't even remember what we have over there these days. Patreon only videos, extra articles and research that come out. We'll be doing our live Q&A to wrap the season this weekend. That's always really fun. And remember to check out that Athletic deal so you can read Seth. It's $1 a month for 6 months. TheAthletic.com/thinkingbasketball. Thanks for listening all the way to the end. Hope you've enjoyed this different non-solo podcast. And of course, wherever you're listening out there, hope you're having a great day.